Broadcasting on 103.2, this is Dublin City FM.
Hello, good evening and welcome to the Astronomy Show here on 103.2 Dublin City FM with John Dixon and myself, Ben Emmett. Firstly, good evening, John.
Good evening, Ben, and hi, everyone.
Hi, everyone, indeed. As ever, our email address is astronomy@dublincityfm.ie and the text and WhatsApp number is 087-179-1032. That's 087-179-1032 and we'll be with you here for the next 28 minutes or so. Lots to get through as usual. What to see in the sky, the upcoming big event, I think, this week. Big event in Irish astronomy and space science research with the launch of Ireland's first satellite, due now on Friday, and you can watch it live on the YouTube channel and the ESA channel, and we'll give you the details about that in a few moments. But we'll start with what to see in the sky over the coming week.
Yeah, and one of my favourites, Venus. The International Space Station.
Oh, dear, indeed. Oh, I have the time for tomorrow.
Yeah, it's been in our skies, evening skies, that is, November the 17th, and is going to disappear on December the 6th. So the time that it's in our skies really marches on quite quickly. And just keep an eye for that date if you want the ones for January next year. So January the 16th until February the 1st. Now, did you see the full moon last night?
I did not.
Yeah, what a clear night we had, and a super full moon. Well, it wasn't a super one, but it's, as we call it, a super moon, but it's a fantastic sight to see absolute full, you know, just as it rises. Mercury, minus 0.4, glimmers very low in the southwest in early twilight, and you can look for it about 30 to 40 minutes after sunset, so it's just sneaking back into our visibility. Binoculars help, of course, with solar filters, of course, and nothing else in that particular area is as bright, so if you do see something of a bright nature, it will be Mercury, just very close to the sun. Venus, great sight, minus 4.2, shines in the southeast just before and during dawn, and it rises about 2 hours just before the dawn's first light. You get to see a good chance of to see that planet in our skies. Unfortunately, Mars still out of our sight.
Yeah, you'll have to wait till the end of the month to get a glimpse of that.
Yeah and again, you're not going to see
the end of, that's the end of December, I hasten to add.
You're not going to see really too much of it either until sort of the end of December into January, but we'll keep you up to date with that as well. Jupiter, on the other hand, it's a good sight. It's up at the moment. Not sure what it's doing outside, but it's been cloudy all day, of course, yeah. Magnitude minus 2.8. It's in Aries, and it's that bright white dot dominating the east in our early evening. So if you wondered what exactly it is, it is Jupiter, and it stands highest in the south around 9 to 10 p.m., depending where you are. And in a telescope, Jupiter is still a big 48 or 47 arc seconds wide, so it's still pretty bright. Saturn, on the other hand, it's easy enough to see still. Plus 0.8 in dim Aquarius. It's glows yellowish at the moment, high in the south at nightfall, and similarly bright is almost two fists at arm's length to Saturn's lower left. There's a star called Formalhaut. That'd be the right way to pronounce that one. Lots of different ways.
Close enough, yeah.
Yeah, and it progresses and sets by about 11, so get your telescope out on that one as well early. And Uranus shyly beckons, 13 degrees east of Jupiter. East, yes, we know where that is, in a telescope at high power. Uranus is a tiny but distinctly non-stellar ball, 3.8 arc seconds in diameter. And Neptune, the elusive one, 7.8 on the scale. And it's high in the early evening, just east of Saturn. So if you want to see the two of them, if you can find your way around the sky, it's a good chance to see both of those together nearly as well. And if you're looking to see exactly where they are, go out into the night, point yourself south, and just look from left to right, And that's really within a few degrees or so where you'll get to see the sun, the moon, all the planets and anything of interest as well coming as we scream through the solar system.
Yes, thank you, John. You mentioned Venus?
Yes.
It is at, oh yeah, today it's at perihelion, which means it's at its closest to the sun at 0.718 of an astronomical unit. And on Saturday, just to let you know, the greater chance, slightly greater chance than normal of seeing a few meteors when on Saturday the Andromeda meteor shower peaks. And you also mentioned Mercury, which is at greatest elongation east on Monday the 4th. Oh, yes, the International Space Station. That's the one I really meant to mention. It was out and about earlier, but as you mentioned, I think it was cloudy. But hopefully tomorrow it will be a bit, the skies will be clearer. And if so, we should be able to see it just about 5:15 tomorrow. In fact, from 14 minutes past 5 until 21 minutes past 5. So that's a nice, good, long pass of 7 minutes as it goes from west to east. And it's a good pass. It's a maximum altitude of 66 degrees and a magnitude of -3.5. So it's quite bright, quite high. And when it's due south of us, it'll only be 460 kilometers away. But when you see it 4 or 5 minutes earlier, it's actually 1,000 miles further away.
Mm-hmm.
So it is traveling at 17,500 miles per hour or there or thereabouts. Now you mentioned, of course, the moon. At the moment, it's a 97% waning gibbous moon because we had the full moon yesterday. And it is currently above the horizon, but sadly with the clouds, can't quite see it at the moment. Might get a few breaks later. And it will be due south just about 20 minutes to 2 tomorrow morning. And when it sets tomorrow at just after 11 a.m., it'll be slightly reduced at 95% phase. And when it rises again tomorrow at 5:15, it will have reduced another slight little bit to 94% as we head towards the third quarter moon, which will be next Tuesday. Sunrise in Dublin tomorrow, 8:13 a.m., 11 minutes later than a week ago. Local noon when the sun passes the meridian and is due south, that's at 13 minutes past 12. And the sun will set at 12 minutes past 4 tomorrow, which is 7 minutes earlier than a week ago. And also 5 to 8 minutes earlier than a week ago. We have from that time, 4:12 until around about 5 to 5, we have civil twilight. And from then until 25 to 6 or so, we have nautical twilight. And from then until 20 past 6, we have astronomical twilight. And after that, it's officially nighttime. What does that mean? It means we'll have 18 minutes less daylight tomorrow than we had a week ago. Another 2 minutes 26 seconds shaved off that again tomorrow, when there'll be 7 hours and 59 minutes between sunrise and sunset. So the day is getting quite short as we head towards the winter solstice on Friday the 22nd, which is not too long away.
It's certainly not.
Not too long away now. And actually the earliest sunset will be on the 13th of December at 4:06 and 11 seconds.
Are you a great spot watcher?
Are we talking about Jupiter now?
The red spot.
Oh, the red spot.
Good time this evening.
No, I've never.
I have.
Not on my own little scope, I've never.
Numerous times.
Never spotted
tonight
it.
Tonight is a good time. In fact, in about 9 minutes' time, it's going to come into our view if the skies are clear enough for us to view. And we will forgive you if you want to dip out before the program ends just to see the red spot. But it will be there for probably an hour or so thereabouts. And then it won't be back in view because it gets bright the next time it's there. But the 29th, that's tomorrow, 5:45 a.m. if you want to see that. Sort of, oh, it's remarkably dark in that hour of the morning.
Oh, yes.
Oh, gee.
Well, as I say, tomorrow the sun rises at 8:13 a.m.
Yeah, and the 30th, just if you're there as well, 1:37 a.m. and then again at 9:28 a.m. So, as we know, the planet whips around quite quickly, about 9 hours, 32 minutes in 1 RPM, 1 revolution. So you have to be very careful about the times to see the Great Red Spot, and it's well worth a look. I have the 8-inch telescope as well.
Can you see it through the 8-inch?
Oh, you can. Oh, yeah. There's no problem whatsoever.
Oh, because no, I've never. Yeah. Maybe so my bad eyes from my
phone. Just been looking at the wrong times.
Could be. Oh, that's true too. Yeah. I've never actually gone out deliberately to. To view it, but I haven't noticed it in the 4-inch refractor. That's a good point. That'll be a little project
for me now. I'll
check the times when it's on view.
Now, I was doing a bit of research into geostationary orbits, just a little bit of nitty-gritties into it. So a geostationary orbit, also referred to as a geosynchronous equatorial orbit, to be correct, it is in an area that's 22,236 miles in altitude above the Earth's equator. Now, it is important that if you're placing a satellite into the geostationary, it must be directly above the equator. Otherwise, it will go offline and you won't be able to see it. So it's got to follow the directions of the Earth's rotation as well. And a lot of communication satellites are often placed up there so they can sort of talk to each other around the Earth in different points, so we get instant, like, for example, news, things like that. You can see
the satellite TV stations.
Exactly.
If you have a satellite on your roof, to get Sky, not just Sky TV, of course, all the other stations and entertainment channels that are available via satellite.
That's why the
satellite is your dish is pointed in one direction.
Mm.
Should I mention one direction? That's another thing. Because the satellite, they're in geosynchronous orbits, and you'll see most of the satellites, all our TV satellites, are pointed slightly to the southeast and quite low. Because we're at 53 degrees north of the equator, they will be pointed quite low towards the horizon. I think those satellites, if you have Sky TV, that satellite is geostationary above somewhere in Africa, like Uganda or somewhere like that. So if you think about it, if you were on the equator, your satellite dish would be pointing straight up, vertically up to the zenith.
Mm.
But because we're so far north, they're just slanted a few degrees above the horizon.
Now, how did it get there? This is the other question.
On a rocket?
On a rocket is right, but a lot of modern-day rockets only are able to propel the ISS and the old space shuttles and any other things at about 17,500 miles per hour, which is not enough to escape the gravity pull, and to get out a bit further. So they have to use something like the heavy lift rockets to get them out to 22,236 miles in altitude into the geostationary orbit as well. So trying to figure out once they're released from that, there's probably space junk left up there at some stage. Whether it just keeps going out further, we just don't know. So I don't think there's much of a chance. And every 15 years or so, they have to be realigned because of the Earth's pull with gravity. But it doesn't, they're way, way out. And it does make an awful lot of difference. But they do have to just fire a little booster every now and again to correct the trajectory of it as well. So quite a complicated thing. Not sure exactly how many satellites are up there. There used to be one. Now there are quite a number of
which one was the first one?
Plenty
of them.
So they're placed that far out, really, so they can see each other without the Earth getting in the way. That's one of the points as well. So they have to use the heavy lift rockets to get them out past 25,000 miles per hour to get them out of the Earth's pull and into the same sort of speed as the escape speed to get to the moon. Thereabouts, 17,500 miles is not quite enough to get them out.
To totally escape the Earth's gravitational pull. Mm-hmm. That's why with the longer-term mission, like JUICE mission, for example, not just the JUICE mission, but instead of building this huge, expensive, powerful rocket to get it to its destination, they can get it out into Earth's orbit with a smaller slightly cheaper rocket, and then what you do is, with a bit of maths and clever cunning, you can get these, put it into an elliptical orbit, and then use the Earth's gravitational pull to give it a bit of a slingshot and speed it up on its way.
Brilliant.
Or you probably don't want to do that with something like a communication satellite, because generally you want them there in a bit of a hurry. You can't wait a couple of years. Like the JUICE mission is, where's it going? It's going to, I think, Jupiter, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And it's a 7-year. If you were to send it straight there, it wouldn't take that long. It would take maybe a year or so, but it's doing a few flybys of, it's even going into Venus and stealing some of that planet's energy to slingshot its way out. In fact, I think it's coming up for recently or soon for an Earth flyby.
Even though it was launched some time ago. They launch them out, then it suddenly comes back to say hello, and then it goes back out again.
Mm. Doesn't make sense,
really, but it does. It gets a slingshot, a good catapult effect. Yesterday's full moon, the Beaver Moon, and the one for December the 27th. At 3:33 a.m. in the morning GMT is the last one of the year, called the Cold Moon. So let's look forward to that as well. And that's the last one for the year. So we'll be getting our list of what they're called and when they are next year, very soon indeed.
Thank you, John. You're listening to The Astronomy Show here on 103.2 Dublin City FM with John Dixon and myself, Ben Emmett. Our email address is astronomy@dublincityfm.ie and the text number is 087-179-1032. That's 087-179-1032. And you can also catch us live on the internet at dublincityfm.ie and also as a podcast. Now, John, Ireland's first satellite, mm-hmm. now due to be launched on Friday.
I'll be waiting for my text.
We were just saying some time ago, when we do watch launches live, it can be a bit nerve-wracking.
It is.
It is, because you never, you know, things can go wrong and they can be...
And we want it to go all right.
We want it to do all right, and we certainly want Friday's launch to go certainly well. I'm just afraid I'll be even more nervous than usual. Mm-hmm. But if you so desire, you'll be able to watch the launch of Ireland's first satellite. Now, it's one of many satellites going up on this particular rocket, from which is going to be launched from Vandenberg Air Force Base in California, I believe. And it's now scheduled for Friday the 1st of December, and you can watch it live. Live coverage starts at at 5:45 GMT or Irish time, Irish winter time, or whatever you want to call it. And you can watch it on ESA's web TV channel 2 and ESA YouTube. And as we mentioned some time ago, it was built by the students at University College Dublin under the guidance of ESA's Education Office. And it's called AirSat 1. It's a two-unit CubeSat carrying three experiments, including a novel gamma-ray detector that will study some of the most luminous explosions in the universe. And you could do worse than watch the 22-minute YouTube video about it. And you see the students from UCD and the professor, Lorraine Hanlon, and the history behind it and how they built it and what it contains and what they hope to achieve. And it's a great moment. And 5:45 on Friday is your opportunity to watch it live on ESA's YouTube or ESA's web TV channel 2.
Yeah, and Alan has just been on. He says, toes crossed.
Toes
Godspeed, the Irish satellite, the private space mission to pierce Venus's clouds. He says, try piercing Kildare's clouds at the moment. Yeah, Jupiter looks spectacularly good when clear. Yes, I haven't seen it this evening, but certainly yesterday. Magnificent, as always. Now, Mars, just going back in a little bit in time, it's been stripped of its atmosphere over the years. A lot of unhealthy gases and things that we would not be able to live on. The liquids have disappeared. It's been stripped. It's quite an uninhabitable place at the moment. But do you ever realize that we're sort of facing the same way, and we lose about 95,000 tons of hydrogen per year and 1,600 tons of helium per year through solar winds and natural what's the word, loosage. Yeah, there's my new word for today. The main factor as well is in gaining a bit of weight is falling material like cosmic dust and meteors, etc. So we do lose quite a lot, which equates to about 3 kilos a second of hydrogen and helium from our atmosphere. But no need to worry, we still have a fair bit left to keep us going.
Well, and once we don't, we'll start losing too much oxygen.
That's true, yeah.
Much of the point.
Yeah. And we don't want that, because that wouldn't be good.
What about the new space race?
Hmm?
Mostly confined to the Korean Peninsula.
Yeah, the two have been launched.
Well, the North Koreans, they claimed last week that they have successfully put their first military surveillance satellite into orbit, and South Korea are planning to send up their first spy satellite on November the 30th. Yeah, 2 days away, on Thursday. So, up to now, and the North Koreans claiming that they have some pictures back from their satellite and of the U.S. base on the island of Guam.
Mm-hmm.
So they say, at the moment now, South Korea depend on the USA for their little surveillance on North Korea, but they hope to do their own thing.
Yeah, and what they're going to do with them now, we're not too sure, but we'll find out in time. And
indeed, we will. And that South Korean satellite is due to launch aboard a SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket. And they'll be able to do their own thing. Anyway, enough of spy satellites.
Yeah, leading from that to the growing challenge of space debris. This keeps coming up almost daily now by all the news channels, as well as humanity ventures deeper into the realm of space exploration and indeed commercialization. The threat posed by space debris has escalated dramatically. And I remember going back to when we started this program almost 20 years ago, there was about 20,000 pieces of space debris that were bigger than 10 centimeters, and a bit few more flecks of paint and things like that. But there are millions of bits up there at the moment, and some of them are big enough to pierce astronauts' suits and to even pierce into the International Space Station's walls as well. So every now and again they have to make a maneuver to do that. So how are they going to do this? So they're just, they do a lot of talking, and as I say, ranging from minute flecks of paint to spent rocket stages. So you definitely don't want to be in the way of a rocket stage.
At least you can see them coming in plenty of time, because there's tens of thousands of pieces being tracked, but they have to be over a certain size. It'll be something huge. You can see it and move the station out of the way.
They track them now down to about 1 centimetre. It used to be 10 centimetres, and anything below that really wasn't a threat, but I think anything travelling at 17,500 miles per hour, luckily enough, most of them are going the same way as the ISS and any of the others, but you get the odd satellite going across a different direction at 90 degrees, but they're all at different levels and trajectories. And every now and again, they have to make a maneuver because the ISS itself, because of Earth's gravity, gets pulled towards the Earth, so they have to jettison back into its proper space. So,
and then you have all the bits in polar orbits that would cross, that intersect those going in equatorial orbits. Well, of course, the ISS isn't in exactly an equatorial orbit. It's inclined, the orbit's inclined at 51 degrees to the equator.
But now they're saying that somebody has the part of the removal marker projected to reach about 0.6 of a billion by 2028. So that'll be through a couple of different companies and things like that to see if they can remove the larger bits. A certain amount will come back down as well, like, for instance, a tool bag that might have been lost last week or the week before. €100,000 worth, or $100,000 worth of a space thing with a couple of grease guns and spanners and WD-40s and all that sort of stuff in it as well.
Yeah, and just continuing on that, I see the NASA are requesting $1 billion for someone to design and build a space tug to deorbit the International Space Station. They say it's the whole space station is far too big for it to completely vaporise if left naturally burn in Earth's atmosphere. So they want a more controlled orbit, something that they can do better than just using the thrusters on the space station itself. They say this plan will take years to develop. The plan is to deorbit it in the year 2030, I believe. And although the Russians say they're going to leave in about 2028, they think they might start building their own space station. But it's another story. And yeah, just when you think it was $100 billion to build, and they're thinking of dumping it, it just sounds... but then again, a lot of this technology on it is what we might call old. How old is the youngest or the oldest module? And when was the early 90s or something, isn't it?
Yep, I think you have it spot on
there. But I suppose nothing lasts forever, but that's... initially Russia said they were going to quit it next year in 2024, but then they've agreed to stay on to 2028. But the plan is in the year 2030 to deorbit the International Space Station. And then we're talking about the Gateway, which is a space station that's actually going to go around the moon.
And we talk about global warming. I was doing a bit of research into the coldest part of the planet. Now, it's down in the plateau in South Antarctica. Or East Antarctica, should I say. And we haven't been there because it's just too cold. It's been recorded at 98.1 degrees below freezing Celsius. And, of course, a little bit further north or south, or north for the Antarctic, we have plus whatever it is, global warming, etc. It's remarkable to think that Antarctica is about 16,000 feet above sea level, where the Arctic is on sea level and is shifting all the time.
Mm. Yeah, there's no landmass under the ice at the North Pole, but there is... actually, I was reading something about that today. I don't really have that much time to go into it, but the ice in Antarctica is melting much faster than they thought it would. And then at certain part, it was basically something like the height of a five-story building, equivalent to that much.
Yeah.
Melting on top of it.
It's huge,
Not to mention underneath it. But anyway, that's another
That's about
story.
It,
that's all the time we have this evening. Thank you, John, for that. And our email address, if you want to pose any questions, comments, queries you might have, we'd love to hear from you. astronomy@dublincityfm.ie is the email address. And thanks to John for his news items and for driving the sound desk. And thanks to James Sweeney and Conor Lennon for putting the show up there on astronomy.ie website. But that's all from me, Ben Emmett, from this edition of The Astronomy Show here on 103.2 Dublin City FM. Up next is Brian Liner with Threads. From 10 p.m. to midnight, we have Ear to the Globe with Nigel Wood. And from midnight till 2 a.m, Dave Barry's mix of jazz, blues and soul in a program called After Hours. But please join myself and John at the same time next week. That's 7:30 p.m. We'll be back with all the latest news from around the universe. Until then, take care of each other. Thank you for listening and say goodnight, John.
Goodnight, John.
Goodnight, John.
Broadcasting on 103.2, this is Dublin City FM.